host. Thank you for joining us or sticking with us on this Wellness Wednesday. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at FirstEdition889. And don't forget to like and follow us on Facebook at First Edition on WEAA 88.9 FM. Go to WEAA.org on our homepage for the latest podcast of First Edition, or subscribe to our iTunes podcast, First Edition. Also, hit me up on my personal Twitter account. The tag is at Sean Yoes. That is my name, S-E-A-N-Y-O-E-S. Or go to my Facebook page. If you have information, insight, or breaking news you want to share with me, I'll share with the people, unless you don't want me to, and I won't. Coming up a little bit later in the second hour, bringing the gift of quality theater to everybody. It's a good idea. It's a great idea. With the Center Stage Mobile Unit, we'll talk about this new initiative to bring theater to underserved communities. Coming up a little bit later in the second hour. But first, on this Wellness Wednesday, Kenyatta Moon, the founder of the Inseroma Academy for Holistic Thought, is in the studio with some thoughts on the importance of holistic education for our children. Kenyatta, yes. Welcome back. Good
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We have a guest, correct?
We do. We have one of our parents from the school. Her name is Emily Kimber, and at our school, we love to call each other Mama and Baba because we, adhere to the adage that the village raises the child. So Mama Emily is on the line with us.
Emily, are you there?
Yes, I am. Peace, yes.
Peace.
Welcome. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. Thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Absolutely.
So let's set up what we want to talk about, Kenyatta, as
yes.
far as education. I mean, obviously, we've talked about different issues on the holistic living segment, but obviously you are the founder of the Inseroma Academy, and educating children is what you do best.
Is what we do, yes.
So let's talk about the school itself and the founding of the school and the reason behind it.
Yes. Yeah, so I know in a prior time we've spoken about why the school was founded. So about 10 years ago, I had a beautiful daughter. She just turned 11. But at that point, at about 10 years ago, I wanted to be at home with her to give her more time. So I established Inseroma Holistic Daycare. And that was a home-based center. And we grew exponentially. Literally, we doubled in size every year with no marketing. And the whole point behind that was that I wanted to raise my daughter in a certain way. And I felt like I could do that for other children. So I wanted her to be exposed to education and enrichment early on. I wanted her to have healthy food daily. I wanted her to be outside and play and explore and learn and love life. And so that's what started us as a childcare center. And then by the time she was four, other parents started asking, well, what are we going to do? Because we are not sending our children to school. And then I realized, oh, my child has to go to school too. So I started to look around and think about places we could all send our children. And I really started to research. Baltimore City schools were not demonstrating the caliber of academic achievement that I wanted to see, nor did I feel like there was a strong emphasis on character development there or health. And so that wasn't really an option. And then when I looked at private school institutions, they were, number one, extremely expensive, really cost prohibitive. And then on top of that, for the mother of African children or children of African descent, African American children of color, really, I did not see when I walked through the halls of these really high-end private schools a representation of what I wanted my daughter to grow up to be. By then, I had two. And so I knew what I wanted for them and who I wanted them to be in the world, how I wanted them to be proud of themselves, know their history, know themselves, be able to get along with anyone from any background, but coming first from a source of knowing and loving self. That was not available to them in any of these private schools. So I decided I had to do it myself.
So Emily, I want to get to you in a moment, but I want to go a little bit deeper and talk about Kenyatta, the holistic learning model. Can
yes.
you describe that?
Yes, generally? Absolutely. So the holistic learning model is something that has been crafted through years of experience. I was blessed to have an opportunity to live overseas for a little over 3 years, and I got to see what education looked like outside of the United States. And then being back in the States, I was again blessed to have an opportunity to work at Maharifa Shule, which at that time was the longest standing African-centered institution in Baltimore. And Mama Kay Stansel and her husband, Macaulay Stansel, who were the founders, she was my educator. She was my first educator as a child. And so I knew what she instilled in me. And I was there full circle as an adult to take part in understanding what cultured or culturally relevant education can do for our children. And so stemming from my experience overseas and just my years in teaching and educating children, I started to develop this model because I could see the need for cultural relevance in our education approach, but also something a little bit outside of what was generally done in Pan-African schools, which was to engage the children in a different way and affect different learning styles. Because now we're dealing with children who are really, really diverse across a broad spectrum of learning and understanding and expression of learning. And so more and more as the school developed, we started getting calls from parents. And I had, even at my Harifa Educated, many children who were not your average learners, your typical learners, and they were being labeled. One by one, we get these calls, and we still do, of especially our boys being labeled ADHD and having all this really broad range of what they're calling disorders. And a lot of times it has to deal with biological needs that they're not having met in terms of food, in terms of exercise. Sometimes it's emotional needs that need to be met. And often it's about how they're learning. And so they're in learning environments that do not stimulate them and do not allow them to be who they are. And furthermore, children who are the most energetic beings on the planet by nature, and then children with melanin in them, that element that makes us brown, we have the highest level of energy because that melanin is actually an asset. But if you're in a very slow moving environment, a very stoic, rigid environment that is telling you that you must be still and you must sit and listen to someone for hours,
drive you crazy.
You literally couldn't drive you crazy.
Yeah. Let me bring Emily into the conversation. Emily, why don't you just tell us in a plain way what your experience has been like being a parent of a child attending the Interoma Academy?
Oh, it's been wonderful. So just to give you a little bit of background about myself personally, I have been in education for over 10 years, and I've taught in traditional schools, public schools, between North Carolina and Baltimore. And when I was expecting my daughter, Io, I knew that what I had experienced just firsthand being a teacher in a public school system was not necessarily the experience that I wanted to pass on to my child. So when I came to Baltimore, and I asked around, you know, and eventually this name, Interoma, came to me. And so I kind of, you know, did some research, and I checked it out. And the very first time I stepped foot into the school, so finally after I did my research, I went and I was bold enough to knock on the door because I was like, what if they don't want me there? Or, you know, I just had all this, like, because it was such a wonderful place. Everything that I heard about it was so wonderful. So I was just like, you know, it was almost like going on a job interview. That's how I felt. As soon as I stepped foot inside of Interoma, I said, this is where I want my child. This is where I want her to be. The school was just so amazing to me, just from the warmth that you experience when you walk in, just from instantly, it's a family atmosphere. You feel it as soon as you come in. It's just so positive. And so for me as a parent, the reason why Interoma is so important to me is because it's like having 10 other parents helping to raise your child and helping to cultivate character and all of these things, you know, that we want for our children. Because like I had in the public school system, and it's not about character building. It's about test scores and it's about, you know, basically making the grade and having the data to put down, you know, to say that our school is successful or we're not successful, but we're trying. And Interoma is just such a different place. It just deals with the whole child. And so I know that if I'm having an issue with my child, that I can go to Mama Kenyatta Or I can go to one of the other mamas in the school or one of the babas and say, you know, this is something that I'm dealing with. And it's not only dealt with at home, but it's also dealt with in school. Just in, you know, so it's that whole approach to making, I mean, creating just wonderful people who are going to basically be the ones to lead our future. So I don't know. It's almost, you know, I get really emotional sometimes when I think about how great this school is, just because I see the other side of education every day, you know, and I'm currently a teacher, you know, in the public schools, and I love what I do. And I love my children.
But given, let me ask you but this, Emily, given the, mm-hmm. given the fact that you know firsthand, literally firsthand, what it's like to educate within the public school system and your child is in Seroma, I mean, could you imagine placing your child in public school after that, having that your child, your daughter, I believe, having that experience?
No, I can't imagine it. I can't imagine it. Honestly, I can't imagine it. Simply because it... You know, because there's so much focus on keeping the children still and, you know, casting away these children who don't fit into sitting still and this kind of, you know, way of learning, this rote memorization that they that they like to, you know, put forth in public schools. And it's just, no, I just to answer your question flatly, no, I can't. I really cannot imagine having to take her out of Seroma. So I don't know what happens because my child is six, you know, and right now the oldest child is Dio, Mama Kenyatta's daughter, who's 11. So I just really need for the school to just keep growing, you know, as the children grow. That's all I can say right now.
And and that's why we keep growing, because it always really is that need. And I think... Mama Emily touched on really the major point of who we are and what we're doing. We are really trying to help cultivate these young beings into these young human beings into living and being the people that will make the change we need to see across the world. So our model is not just about, you know, serving Baltimore, although we know that we do and we will. We're really about serving, providing service to the world, because at this point, we, you know, I hear your show often, Sean. I don't really listen to the news, really. You know, it's too really traumatizing. But I know peripherally the state that of things that we're in. And this is worldwide. This is not a Baltimore or Maryland or United States thing, but it is rough on the planet. And, you know, it's because we are not coming from a center of thinking about collectivism. It's all about individualism. Even in the way that we're taught to teach our children, it's about competition, and not in a healthy way, not in the way that helps us grow and think and you know, brings opportunity for choice, but really tear one down to build yourself up. And we're not going to make it. Like, as a human species, we don't make it that way. We only make it through collective effort.
Let me ask you this question, Kenyatta. Kind of touching back to the choice that Emily, if she had, was confronted with the choice of placing her child into a public school setting.
Mm-hmm.
Is it even possible to have a implement a holistic learning model in a public school setting?
Yeah, so that's one thing that we have been working on, and something that is actually in place and ready for launch. So what we've understood across these years, and this has been, you know, an inherent challenge with the model, we're an independent school. And we're independent because we needed to start in a way that would have no oversight from the state, never ending up like, you know, even some of the brilliant charter schools who start out with these great models, but eventually they have to pass these standardized tests. And so they've got to change their model and things like that. And so we looked at that model and we said, no, we're going to be independent because we want to decide how we teach. And so along those years and through the experience, we've, you know, this holistic learning model has been cultivated. And so the next step is taking that model outside of the doors of Seroma or the walls of limitation of that one building, and taking it so that if you are a public school teacher, you can use it in your classroom. or the Department of Education can decide to have it as a model that they can implement within all schools. It can be used for homeschoolers. It can be used for parents who just want to supplement and support their children at home. It can be used for other private schools and charter schools. So the model itself is cultivated in a way that, yes, now we can take this model and teach it and allow other programs to benefit. And it doesn't take away from how they're required or what they're required to teach by the state requirements. But it teaches teachers how to teach in a new way, in a different way. And one thing that I think is important to understand is that when we teach using the holistic learning model as educators, because I've taught in other ways, this makes our work easier. And I think Mama Emily can even touch on the fact that everyone is dealing with what strain and stress the students are under, but the teachers are humans and they have to go in these same sick buildings and they have to face that classroom of 30 students who are many malnourished and underrested and not cared for. And they have to try to do their jobs with the pressure from their higher ups on them constantly.
Quickly, let me ask you mm-hmm. as far as number, before I want to take a quick phone call, but let me ask you as far as the number of students you only have, how many students do you have in each class?
Right. So we have two classrooms, and in our youngest classroom, which is a pre-K through first grade classroom, we have 12 students. And then in our older classroom, we have 8.
That's
beautiful.
Obviously
it's so beautiful.
Extraordinary ratio, obviously, of teacher to student.
Yes.
Let's take a phone call real quick. Let's go to Donna in Baltimore. Donna, you're on with Kenyatta Moon. How you doing?
Pretty good. How you doing?
Hi.
For your guest. You're speaking some really good things. Because I came from a family of teachers, and the stresses, I agree with you, the stresses of being a teacher is just as great as the kids coming to school stress and, you know, whatever. But my question is, when you come with a holistic method in a public school system, it appears that a lot of the, unless you take it to private or parochial or some other school system, it seems like when you're in an urban environment, the school systems are not there to holistically uplift the entire environment from the children to the teachers. Their goal is to teach, get numbers, pay bills, and whatever. How
Yes.
would you be able to convince the school board in Baltimore or even across the state in other counties that are faced with this to use this holistic approach? And I'll hang up and listen. And thanks so much.
Thank you, Donna.
That's such a great question, because you're right. That is the method and the model currently. And so it does require a change in perspective for the school board and for the state, you know, legislatures. And so we actually have some people that we have been starting this dialogue with, this conversation with, in political positions. And we're also, I think today is a really great day to make the rally call, because really what we need, Donna and any other listeners, is we need people like you, people who will come from education, people who know, who are ready and willing to advocate for the children and for the educators, and get together and support the movement of getting the school board, getting the state to start to recognize a model like this and give the opportunity for us to come in and make this really, this holistic learning model is something that, again, does not detract from having to teach to pass Common Core, you know, curricula and things like this. But what it does is it creates a model and a method for how to teach so that everyone in that building feels better and feels aligned and feels comforted, and the children are less stressed and the adults are less stressed. So if there are folks who are ready to advocate for that and ready to make that work, then what we need is people who are willing to come forward and say, okay, put me on the team. Let's get this out there. Let's get in front of the people who make those decisions for the school board and make this not only a professional development model, but something that is an ongoing training for teachers and the administrators of the school.
Do you not have an event coming up?
We do. So one of the challenges, of course, that we face is funding, because we are an independent program. And so, again, we are seeking not only to support our school, because like Mama Emily said, she's wondering how she's going to, or what she will do with her daughter if Inseroma doesn't stay open. And so that's a challenge we face. How do we stay open year after year? And so we have two fundraisers coming up I want to tell everybody about. This Saturday, the 22nd, we have something called Poetic trance. It is a really great event featuring over 15 poets and musicians. And this is going to be held at the Living Well, which is 235 Holiday Street on second floor. It's Saturday, April 22nd from 6 to 9 p.m. It's only $20 at the door or $15 in advance. And this was put on by one of our parents, Janaki Watts, and community supporters Melvin V-Lines Bay and Justin Hatcher. And then we have another event, a fundraising event. Another community member, Jaleela Arlene McDuffie, put on a children's incentive estate sale. And that is going on through April 29th. And she's hosting that at 4702 Eugene Avenue for, and everything that's being sold is there to support our school. So, you know, there are people who are in the community doing the work. We are trying to keep funds going, but not only to fund our daily operations, but to help get this model again outside of our walls and to support educators and children in this city and beyond.
Emily Kimber is a parent of a child at the Interim Academy. Emily, very well done. Thank you for your time this evening. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mom Emily.
You're welcome.
Love you.
And love you too.
Kenyatta Moon is founder of the Interim Academy for Holistic Thought. She's co-host of the Holistic Living segment here on First Edition. Thank you, Kenyatta. Appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to go to a break. When we come back, we are going to talk about bringing theater to the people. Center Stage is doing just that with a mobile theater unit. Stay tuned. You're listening to First Edition. Here on WEAA 88.9, I'm Sean Yose, your host, winding down a Wellness Wednesday and talking about something that is near and dear to my heart, the promulgation of theater, promoting theater, bringing theater to the people. And Baltimore Institution Center Stage is doing just that with their new mobile theater unit. In the studio with me is Brother Daniel Bryant. He's Community Programs Director and Artistic Producer at Center Stage. Daniel, good to see you, man.
Hey, thanks for having us on the show.
Absolutely. We just connected. on a personal level through house music.
Hey, nothing like it.
The brothers from Chicago, so I told him about the world famous. Everybody who's listening knows what the world famous is.
That's right.
So we'll talk more about that at another date. But you're here, man, to talk about the good work of Center Stage, Brother Kwame Arma, of course. But the mobile theater unit, how did that come to be? What is it?
It's all about bringing theater, quality theater, to communities that don't have access to it. And the original idea of it actually was born more than 15 years ago at a theater out in Minneapolis, Minnesota called 10,000 Things. And it's a small theater company, but they do miraculous work. And all of their work is based on this model, literally stripping down the productions to it's a strong story, no set, no lights, minimal props and costumes and actors that go into communities in all kinds of spaces and tell the story and engage the audience. And that's what Mobile Unit here at Baltimore Center Stage is all about. I visited 10,000 Things as a part of the research, and Kwame Kwe Arma, who's the artistic director at Baltimore Center Stage, has been adamant about Maryland's state-funded theater company representing Maryland in its totality. And so it's literally about breaking down the walls of theater. And wherever there's an open space, wherever there's a homeless shelter, wherever there's elderly homes, wherever there's underserved schools and detention centers and prisons, that's where we want to bring our work.
So let's, and I want to get into the benefit of it. And the benefit is infinite, really, when you really think about it. But how does it work? Like, specifically, how does, I mean, from the actual actors getting together and being able to transport them, and, mm-hmm. and how do you mm-hmm. how do you facilitate being able to bring that theater experience to a place where it typically would not be?
Well, funny enough, you should ask that. That's the learning curve that I'm on. I'm only new to Baltimore Center Stage, but 3 months now.
Wow,
I have to look at one of my colleagues here to make sure, but I think it's been 3 months. I moved here New Year's Eve.
Wow.
And so, yes, so I hit the ground running, and this has been my major focus, getting the mobile unit up on its wheels, so to speak. And it starts with choosing a script. And we spent significant time thinking about what we wanted to do, how we wanted to do it. And once we chose the script, then it's all about holding auditions, finding those actors. And it takes a particular kind of actor to do the kind of work that we're doing. It's not about a review or being critiqued, you know, and getting that kind of publicity. It's about generous artists who love the craft of theater and want to give back in some shape or form. And be able to kind of not only deal with audiences that are typically at theaters, but audiences all around the globe,
right.
You know, meaning different sectors of the society that we live in. And so once we chose the actors, then we go through an abbreviated rehearsal process, 3 weeks, where we, as I said earlier, we have no set. We conceptualize what are the basics that we need to set up anywhere that right. Allows us to be mobile. And once we have that concept and design, once we have the script intact, then we rehearse for 3 weeks. And we are actually in our third week.
Wow.
Next Tuesday kicks off our first official inaugural tour here in Baltimore. And so it's about getting the script in the body as an artist, understanding what is the story that we want to tell as the collective of artists. And I happen to be directing this this piece. So having those conversations with the artistic team, and that includes the designers, because we do have pieces
right.
that we bring in to help set the world of the play. It causes us to kind of really be specific about what those pieces are. What's the minimal thing that we can have in a room that
right.
gives a person the idea of
right.
the world that this play is taking place in?
Wow.
And so we're here now with four days left of rehearsal before we step out into the world.
Crunch time.
Yes, sir. Yes,
time.
Sir.
So, okay. What's the piece that y'all are doing?
We're doing a classic piece called Endgame by Samuel Beckett.
Okay.
Endgame. And it's what's called an absurdist comedy. And the reason why we chose Endgame is because of its access point. For those in your studio audience who may not know what absurdist comedy is, it's typically very abstract mm-hmm. theater with very abstract language. And some would, even the most avid theater goer, may find it somewhat challenging. But at the same time, there's such an access point. Samuel Beckett did a show, another play called Waiting for Godot. And same style of theater, absurdist comedy, which deals with existentialism, asking about the questions of what is life and, you know, the cyclical elements of life that you seem to get caught in. And we all as human beings have had those
yes,
moments,
sir. Yes, sir.
Right?
Yes, sir.
And so at that point, with Waiting for Godot, it's the same themes. And he performed that play in a prison, San Quentin prison. And the critics were saying how ridiculous it was to do that. They won't ever understand it. Well, they understood it.
Of course they did.
Their minds were blown. And from then on, one of the prisoners in that audience took on Beckett, and every Beckett play that was produced or written, rather, Samuel Beckett was adamant to have that show done in those prison systems. So the reason why we chose Endgame is because, listen, even the most avid theater goer has to let go whenever they know they're stepping into the theater and dealing with one of his plays. They have to let go of any preconceived notion and start from scratch. That play is going to be whatever that play means to that person. And so my thought in choosing Endgame was, hey, listen, let's do the same thing in our communities that we're serving. You know, start where so they can allow their own personal perceptions of the play be what it is and hopefully have a fantastic experience around the end of it. Does that answer your question?
No, absolutely. It
Good.
Does. Because, you know, when you've only been in Baltimore for 90 days or so.
Yeah.
But our city, obviously, there are myriad challenges to our city. It's one of the most beautiful cities in the country.
It is.
And has some of the most beautiful people. And we have some of the biggest problems.
Mm.
And because of that, people need healing.
Yes.
Culture is one of the great healers.
Absolutely. Yeah. Culture heals everything, I think. I mean, that's one of the reasons why we are doing the mobile unit, because it's, you know, people think that by making choices, whether your choices cause you to go to prison or, you know, your choices cause you to be homeless, or maybe there was no choice in all that and things happened in your life. Oftentimes, those segments of society, we tend to forget. We tend to, obviously, you know, they're underserved, but everyone deserves art. Art changes lives. Art is transformative, whether it's visual art or performance art. And I know that personally because of the impact art had on my life. It was not on my radar screen, but I saw a play and something about it grabbed me. Mm. And from then on, my whole life has been shifted. And so the hope with Mobile Unit is that we choose a play that whatever community that we're servicing, that they get something out of it. It's a time of reflection, that they see something on that stage or in that space, in a character or a situation that they can grab a hold of and hopefully find some deeper understanding for themselves and share their understanding with us, because it's a give and take situation.
Of course.
When we're rolling into these homeless shelters, we're rolling into their homes. So we want to be respectful. And just as we have something to give, I know, and I've been talking with our team, that we have something to get from these folks, and we have to allow ourselves to be humbled and transformed by our connection with these various communities.
Let me ask this, and I don't mean this to be a curveball at all.
No,
or an audible.
Uh-oh.
But I know that you all did a pilot of this last year, and obviously you weren't here, Daniel. But I mean, was there communication? Were there conversations about what transpired last year in the pilot kind of phase of it, or is that something that you kind of stayed away from?
No. I took in that information. I was given a brief description about what they did and how they did it. And obviously something about that inaugural or that pilot program resonated, caused Kwame to be even more passionate about getting the mobile unit out there. One of the things that we realized is that we wanted to increase the quality of performance. Now, that pilot program was staff members and who had lots of passion, led by one of our educational coordinators at that time. Community and education were under one umbrella at Baltimore Center Stage. So there was passion. There was a vision at that time, and they just went with it. This time, what we're doing differently is we're hiring professional actors. The script is a little more challenging, and the process is stretched out so that we're treating it like any other play that we have on the main stage. Literally, we want to make sure that whatever we're doing in the communities has the same quality, the same attention to detail that we have on the main stages at Baltimore Center Stage, because quite frankly, everyone doesn't have access to those seats, whether it's financial or physical ability to get to the theater. So we're not shortchanging. We're actually eventually, not this year, but next year, going to have, in addition to the 2-week tour throughout the city, we're going to have a 2-week sit down at the theater so that our patrons that can go can see the exact same thing that we're doing out in the community and hopefully not see a difference in the quality of the work.
Wow, outstanding. So the end game is going to be from April 25th to May 5th.
Yes.
So where are y'all going to go during that time?
We've got a variety of folk places. We're going to Baltimore Outreach Services, Sandaltown, Senior Citizens Home. We're going to Restoration Gardens. We're going to Healthcare for the Homeless. We're going to Esperanza Center, which is a refugee, a school for refugee or English as a second language school. We're going to the Maryland State Library for the Blind, and then to Yo Baltimore. And then we're finishing up at Weinberg, a homeless center.
So You perform the endgame in each one of these.
We will. Yes. Yeah.
Well, when you say you need a special actor, you're not kidding.
Absolutely.
They have to have some serious duration.
Because when we roll into these spaces, you have no idea what's going to happen. You know, it's literally thinking on your feet, and the show must go on. Yep. So the commitment that the actor
I know you know.
So the actor has to not only think about his or her lines and what we're doing, but also has to be consciously aware of the environment. And, you know, theater decorum is not something that's born. It comes out of habit. And we're very clear that when we come into these spaces, that expectation should not be there. So we might have somebody walking across the stage or people yelling and all of that. That's part of the gig, you know? And my hope is that eventually, once we continue to bring these tours into the community, that it's something that they look forward to, and they clearly do, because some of these venues, a few of them we visited last year with the pilot, and they were so excited to have us back. And so the idea is about literally opening the minds and giving some folks something to look forward to that maybe wasn't on their radar screen, much like it wasn't on mine when I was young.
So let's talk about, you mentioned the fact that, you know, theater really, once you saw your first play, that was not on your radar screen. What was it about seeing that first performance that energized you and propelled you into choosing it as a profession?
I think it was the opportunity to express. The opportunity to express emotion and to have that emotion impact the audience. It's powerful.
Yeah.
And I really appreciated when I saw the actors up there giving something and literally watching the audience respond, having me respond and then looking at the audience and seeing this shared response to words, the way this person spoke and the emotion that he or she was revealing. And it started getting me to, and that, some, I don't know, as a kid that just resonated with me. I have two brothers. Older brother was a visual artist. The younger brother wasn't there and it wasn't born yet. But I had always wondered, what's my talent? What do I, and I have nothing I'm passionate about.
Right.
Something about theater spoke to me.
Right.
And I wanted to be around that. And so that literally set me on the course to, as a kid, to be in theater clubs and join the community theater. And then as I started pursuing it as a professional actor, that wasn't enough for me. You know, it's one thing to be on stage and have that power, but I felt like there was something else I wanted to do that make a difference, quite frankly. And I started directing, you know, thinking that maybe I could, from the director's seat, bring in actors and, you know, think about the venues that I wanted to bring a show to. That wasn't enough. And then I started becoming a teaching artist, which was going into the communities and creating after school programs, bringing theater to those after school programs and watching how giving those kids the same opportunity that I had when I was a kid.
Indeed.
Yeah. And so it just kind of snowballed to producing, which is all about having a vision of an idea and seeing it from beginning to end and being able to choose. I want to make a difference in this community or around this issue, and then creating it from beginning to end and making it happen.
We've talked about the challenge to the actor or actors in putting on this type of production, and even the logistical challenges. But as a director, putting this on from your specific perspective, Dane, we'll talk about some of the challenges of directing this type of production.
Well, I think the biggest thing, in a way, even though we don't have critics coming, which is something typically I think some artists, directors in particular, are thinking about, I, as a director, have found this to be particularly challenging in a positive way, like in a way that I've never thought of. But understanding the variety of audiences that I just went through and shared with you that we're exploring, the commitment to that people get it is high on my list, you know? Paying particular attention to the language and how the actors are communicating a specific thing. I'm well aware, as much as I can be, that the communities, all communities, are facing challenges.
Absolutely,
right?
True.
And issues that are far bigger than any play. But if I can just give them an hour and 20 minutes of being connected to something that allows them an escape, but yet at the same time gives them some amen corner, so to speak, through the language, then we've done our due justice. And so I've been listening to the script and really coaching these actors that, listen, it's not about, you know, actors like to be subtle sometimes, you know, and they have to be led by their hearts in a way, I think, in this process that most actors don't have an opportunity to do. If that makes sense.
Sure, sure, sure.
You know, the clarity of message, the clarity of what you want when you say that line needs to be crystal clear and cut through all the noise.
Right.
So that theatergoers or non-theatergoers, people who are, this is the stillest they'll be ever, that they grab it, they understand.
In a way.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. But in a way, it almost sounds like this is really getting to the essence of what theater is. I mean, really the essence of what theater is.
Honestly, I think it's the purest form of theater. And I've always been attracted by, I love bells and whistles. Who doesn't? You know, we got a lot of bells and whistles. I love technology. I love the purpose of it and how it can take any production to another level. That being said, I have always had a passion for the bare bones. Mm-hmm. I've always had a passion for watching a play, bare stage, minimal cost, like what we're doing. But it's all about the actor and the words and the storytelling. Because truthfully, all that technology can't surpass anybody's imagination. If we say we're in the desert and it's, you know, you've got no pine tree, no trees at all, but in the far distance you see this sparkling lake. And maybe to the left you see this beautiful sunset, and then you see this butterfly flying from a distance that keeps getting larger and it's filled with brilliant colors. Well, your mind will create that vision, and it's much more pure, much more vivid than anything we could put on stage. So it's all about activating the minds of our audiences in a way that maybe they haven't spent thought of because they're, you know, looking for a home. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And so to give them an hour and 20-minute opportunity to just kind of expand and tap into their imagination or have their imagination be challenged or opened in some kind of way, I think that's a benefit as well.
You know, the timing of this production for the Endgame, as you'll travel around the city to in service, really, to some underserved communities in Baltimore, you come right at the time of the second commemoration of, or commemorating the second year, 2 years since the uprising in Baltimore. So the timing right now in some of these specific communities is absolutely right on time and much, much needed.
Wow. Well, that's good to know. I had not really thought about that. I wasn't in Baltimore at the time of the uprising. So that's the larger power at work.
Indeed.
I think, you know, it's interesting that you say that because the message is in Endgame. As I mentioned, it's an abstract, or could be considered an abstract story, but the basic fundamental plot is these four people who are stuck in a room. There's a man who's blind in a wheelchair. There's his parents, it's abstract, who are stuck in trash cans. They have no limbs. And then they have one person who's just stuck in a room and serving them all. And they're forced as a community to live in this world, in this little room, post-apocalyptic, after the world has ended. But they're forced to rely on each other, and they all are fighting to stay alive. And the one thing that they all want is love, to give it, to be loved, all of that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm one to believe, as idealistic as it may sound, that love cures all. And that's the beginning, that awareness that we cannot do this alone.
Well, I mean, it may sound idealistic to some people, but it's true, because that's all anybody wants, truly. You can characterize it any kind of way you want, but ultimately, from the most depraved individual, really, to the most idealistic, everybody wants love.
That's exactly it.
And it motivates and informs all of our actions, seemingly.
Yeah, and we all don't know how to ask for it or
right.
when we need it. And that's another piece that we're exploring in the play of Endgame. You know, how forgiveness or past pains and hurts get in the way of either giving that love or asking for it.
Absolutely.
So my hope, if I could have a big overall super hope, it would be that whoever's in the audiences that we serve, that they see some part of themselves or their family, and that, you know, that hope or that potential to love and open and forgive shows up for them.
So once this is a smashing success, as I know it's going to be, is there plans in place to go do another round of?
Oh, absolutely. This is going to be an annual thing,
okay.
You know, and each year we'll choose another play, and each year we'll take it through the process. As I said, next year, the only difference moving forward is that we'll have 2 weeks for the public to come and check out what we're doing. For mobile unit. But yeah, it's something that's going to be continual. And eventually the hope is that once we introduce the plays to these communities, and you know, the fondness and joy for theater grows, that we eventually begin to partner with these venues and how we can create, along with the folks there, how we can create a piece together so that they're not just there watching a play that might impact them, but it's a play about them, devised by them, and that has ramifications that are nothing but positive in my world.
Absolutely. So let me ask you this before we run out of time.
Mm-hmm.
How do organizations, entities, get on the list, if you will, to become a part of the Center Stage mobile experience? What's that process?
Well, they can email me. Can I give my email?
Sure.
If you're a part of a non-profit or an organization, period, of underserved folks, whether you're homeless shelter, temporary housing, what else, elderly home, a school, and you have a space that's at least 10 feet by 10 feet. That's the smallest. So I would actually say 14 by 14 would be ideal. But either way, you can email me at D as in Daniel or dog, Bryant, B-R-Y-A-N-T, at centerstage.org.
Okay.
All right.
Daniel Bryant is the Community Programs Director, Artistic Producer for Center Stage. He is going to be directing the play Endgame by Samuel Beckett. It is going to be traveling to different areas, different locations around the city from April 25th to May 5th, serving desperately needed community or communities that are desperately underserved.
Mm-hmm.
Bringing the healing power of culture and theater specifically to those communities. And much respect to you all.
Hey,
for putting this together, man.
Thank you. Thank
and
you.
Welcome
for
to Baltimore.
Us.
Tell my man Kwame Quay, I'm looking for him. He needs to come to the world famous.
I'll bring him to the house party.
Yeah,
he likes
dope.
Music.
Yeah, I know he does. Uh-huh. Yes, he does. Daniel, thank you, man. Appreciate you.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. That is it for us. That is it for First Edition. It is a production of WEAA. The show is produced by executive producer Sean Yoes and associate producer Iyoyo Digizua. Our board operators are Andre Melton and Ty Rice. Our First Edition interns are Isaiah George, Wyman Jones, Kristen West, Janelle Ferguson, Alex Blanc, Deja Braggs, Jonathan Williams, Miracle Choku Kaize, Drew Mitchell, and Valentin Davis. Stay tuned for the relationship experience with my man Changa Bell next, right here on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM. The voice of the community. I am Sean Yoes. Peace.